Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
I was asked to talk about neurobiology and the soul, and I thought that no sane person would try to do that. So I changed my title a little bit. Here's my title, to be a little bit more biological. But I'm going to take the risk of talking to you guys who know a lot more than I do about some information technology things, just simply because it provides a very useful heuristic in thinking about what human beings are. And I don't know quite how to do this presentation because I don't exactly want to read it to you, but I know I want to get the wording precise, so I'll just come in and out on that. But if you want, you just interrupt me and we can turn it all into one big conversation. It's a really, really difficult subject, but an exciting one, I think a really crucial one. So I'm going to start by introducing this whole subject through a sort of analysis of where we're at in our kind of a scientific approach, our assumptions to the notions that would have some relevance to the idea of soul. So in 1799, the French Academy of Sciences offered a prize of 1 kilo of gold to anyone who could explain alcohol fermentation. For 6,000 years, fermentation had been regarded as a mysterious power of transformation, a meeting of the material and the spiritual. It's a connection still evident in the way we use our English word spirits for liqueurs or alcoholic drinks. But by the late 18th century, in the age of science, a bitter dispute arose between those representing the new field of chemistry and the traditional vitalists who maintained that life processes are not reducible to explanations in terms of physiochemical mechanisms. So Lavoisier had noted that the powers of fermentation could be transferred with residual sediments. And by the middle of the 19th century, Schwann, he's a guy who gave us cell theory, Schwann had established that cells are the basic units of life and that yeast cells could be found in these fermentation sediments. So the role of the yeast cells was confirmed by Pasteur. Pasteur was actually kind of a vitalist, and he maintained that only within the living system of the cell, with its mysterious immaterial vital forces, could the powers of fermentation be manifest. But in 1897, the German chemist Eduard Buchner prepared an extract of yeast cells and noted that this clear, slightly yellow, filtered fluid was fully capable of fermentation, even apart from its cellular source. This discovery led to the isolation of the enzymes of fermentation and the chemical description of this fundamental organic process. Our word enzyme comes from the Greek word zyme, meaning leaven, another function of yeast. With this final blow to vitalism, the field of biochemistry was born, and with it, the reductive and analytic approach to the study of life. And that's what I'm getting at here. We all know the story from here. By breaking down living systems into their component parts, we've made great progress in basic biology. Looking at living beings in terms of inanimate matter, we've provoked a veritable revolution in biology with the promise of dramatic powers for intervention at the very foundations of life, and we all know that's happening. Novel recombinant plants for food or fuel, better vaccines, pharmaceuticals, bioengineered bacteria to eat oil spills. We've even got a monkey with firefly genes. He glows in the dark. So we're moving in and operating on life. Geeps, the chimeric creature made from the fusion of goat and sheep embryos and so forth. Increasingly, we've come to regard all of living nature as mere matter and information to be reshuffled and reassigned to the projects of the human will. But this is not just a revolution in our technical control over the world in which we dwell. It's also a radical revision in our self-understanding, our concept of human life, and our sense of place and purpose within the cosmic order. The nature we know through modern biology is not the nature we know through ordinary experience. There's a sense that what is most important and distinctly human has somehow slipped through the grasp of our science. The new objectified conceptions of human nature fall short of cohering with the fullness of life as actually lived and experienced. They fail to sustain our sense of irreducible personal identity, our capacity for free choice, and our commitment to ideals and transcendent truths. Nearly 400 years ago, at the dawn of the scientific revolution, the French scientist and philosopher Blaise Pascal noted, he lamented actually, he said, "When I commenced the study of man, I saw that these abstract sciences are not suited to man, and I was wandering further from my own state in examining them than others in not knowing them." So this reductive and analytic approach of our new science, of our understanding wholes in terms of parts, living things in terms of dead matter and motion, this has culminated in the sequencing of the human genome. The 20th century was the era of molecular biology. This is a really important point, especially those of you in computer science. So understand, biology is moving now from being the era of direct genomics onto proteomics, that's the production of proteins and the study of them, and then on, and most importantly, to the study of developmental biology. We've returned now to the realm of living beings, and with it, to the study of systems neurobiology and cognitive psychology. And also, by the way, to a lot of moralistic issues, because what you did with biomolecules in the test tube didn't come with too much concern. But now we're at the level of living things, and when it comes to studying human development, the issue again, as with embryonic stem cells 20 years ago, it's now living human embryos that are on the table and being used for research like raw materials instrumentally used. So it's a complicated moment. But what's more important in a sense than just the direct and obvious challenges of the practical and conceptual framing of what we do with this with regard to human life, there is, it's striking how our current mode of operation, our current methods of science are confronted with their own inadequacy. Our scientific methodologies and metaphors are not equal to the current task. We're confronted with our inability to account for the mystery of these living subjects. That is, for their subjectivity, and human beings, for our sense of inward awareness and our sense of self, our integrated unity and vitality as passionate and purposeful beings. Now, most of neurobiology is still going on, or much of it is still going on at the level of molecules and simple circuits. But looming over this is the mystery of how we arrive at conscious, subjective beings. Challenged by disquieting technological advances such as ChatGPT, cerebral organoids, and synthetic embryos, we sense we must reframe and rethink our scientific assumptions. We need to humbly reopen perspectives discarded by mainstream science long ago, and search out a deeper and richer understanding of the vitality of living nature. We must seek a new and integrated synthesis of modern scientific knowledge with the ancient insights conveyed in the concept of soul. Soul, it's such a strange word, isn't it? In our modern world, we use this soul food, soul music, soulmate. That's one you guys know, right? Soulmate. Everybody's looking for that. We speak of a lost soul, heart and soul, body and soul. Across time and place, nearly every culture studied has had some notion of soul. There's a huge thing called you guys ever heard of this? Murdoch, this anthropology guy, did this human relations files, they're called. And he studied, I think it's like 1,100, 1,500 cultures. Virtually everyone had some kind of notion of soul, generally describing some incorporeal or immortal aspect of human nature, and sometimes of animal natures as well. For Western culture, there's a rich heritage of notions of soul as the immaterial essence, the animating principle, or the actuating cause of an individual life, the principle embodied in human beings as rational and spiritual beings. Although in popular parlance, the soul is often construed as some kind of a ghost in the machine, in its Greek foundations and ancient Judeo-Christian tradition, the idea of soul is a deeper and more compelling concept, one that can inform and enlighten both our modern scientific understanding and our essential need for a modern spiritual notion of the human person. For Aristotle, the soul is the animating principle, that which realizes or makes actual what is otherwise merely potential. You're probably vaguely aware of Aristotle's notion of hylomorphism, and it's really quite fascinating to think of in relationship to the discoveries of modern physics and so forth. Aristotle's idea of the four causes, you remember that, the formal, material, efficient, and final. And he had this notion that all the world was made out of some kind of primordial material, he called it, but it wasn't material even in the sense of elements. It was some undifferentiated thing, sometimes translated as the word chaos that we use in the Bible for the spirit hovering over the water and bringing order out of chaos. But complementing that raw potential was the actualizing power of form. So the Judeo-Christian concept of soul is expressed in the word, the Hebrew word, nefesh, variably translated as soul or spirit, but also as living being, person, heart or mind, desire or disposition of will. Nefesh is also the Hebrew word for breath, carrying the mystery of our invisible spiritual nature. You remember in Genesis, God breathed into the nostrils of Adam, and he became a living being. But the word in Hebrew does not imply that the soul was somehow delivered into the body as a separate element. Rather, Adam became, it's awkward to translate it this way, but Adam became soulish, not a soul in a body, but a psychophysical unity, inseparably body, mind, and spirit. It's notable that in modern English, our word psychiatry comes from two Greek words, psyche and iatros, which iatros means healer or physician. So the psychiatrist is the soul doctor, a concept we might do well to recognize anew. I think it would help us if we did psychiatry with the full mystery of the human in mind. If we turn now to the dilemma of our modern scientific technological age and seek a richer and fuller account of the human person, we gain insight by exploring in two ways our most challenging and two of our most challenging contemporary developments. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to explore this idea through two of the things that are very much on most everybody's mind these days: the disquieting human-like powers of large language models and the moral meaning of our emerging biotechnology. And I want to say a few things about cerebral organoids and synthetic embryos. Both of these arenas carry important insights on the meaning of soul and the inseparable unity of body and mind, and both are raising conceptual and practical problems of profound importance for the human future. So first, with information technologies, and here I'm a little on shaky ground, so if I start to say anything wrong, just start coughing or something, okay? But I think I get the basic idea of what's going on, even if it's disarmingly weird and it's disturbing in a way and exciting in another way. So what are we to make of predictions of conscious machines, neuromorphic computers or robotic servants, caregivers, and companions? Can human nature be reduced to information processing? Are we, as MIT Professor Marvin Minsky said, just a meat machine? In light of this escalating momentum of scientific advance and our shifting cultural assumptions and social attitudes, it seems clear that we need a clarification of the terms, concept, and a priori assumptions within which our ideas of human nature are established and expressed. We need to pause and think more deeply about who we are and where we're heading. What do we think we are as beings? And this is always on my mind because this is basically what I teach about, but I also served on the President's Council on Bioethics during the stem cell debates and really rivetingly put forward the question of what is a human being? Why do we treat human beings as special, with special sense of inviolability or even sacredness? And what at what stage or what manifestation of human properties do we endow these creatures with that exalted category? So our biotechnology is offering us opportunities for interventions at levels just unimaginable, I think, even for people 100 years ago, not to mention all through human history. And you stop to think about it, it's in our era, your lives, that for the first time since the beginning of life, which is variably placed, 3.5, 3.8, maybe even 4, 4.2 billion years ago, for the first time, there's a creature who can intervene with some measure of effectiveness in its species of long-term evolution. So it's an amazing moment and a very crucial moment for us to think more deeply about what it means to be a human being. And the information technology, the computer analogy, and the specifics of what's going on can inform us, and in what I'm going to argue here, they can inform us about what we're not as much as what we are. As we explore our varied approaches, it's immediately obvious that there are two radically and seemingly incompatible terms of description which frame our self-understanding as human beings. One is from the detached and objective view of the empirical sciences. You all know that one. And in your studies, the other is from our subjective inward experience as sensitive, passionate, and purposeful living beings. And you know that because you're a living human being, passionate and purposeful. The descriptive terms of the physical sciences, matter and energy expressed in the language of mathematics, are in sharp contrast with the more human-level approaches of phenomenology, aesthetic thought, and personalism, where concepts such as mind, beauty, and spirit are often used to refer not just to humans, but to perceived core realities of the cosmos itself. As physicist Russell Stannard noted, we draw on this more personal level when describing the very source and sustaining power of all reality. Our language about God as creator and ground of being is drawn from inward experience and expressed in personal terms, such as love, purpose, compassion, goodness, and morality. Expressions that do not figure in physics equations, nor in computer models. He goes on to say that language used in reference to God is fundamentally that of consciousness, the aspect of human life that is at once most subjectively evident, yet most inexplicable within the current conceptual and methodological tools of empirical science. I'm sure you all are very aware that there's a dense and difficult dialogue going on about what is consciousness. And everybody knows Schomburg said there's two dimensions. There's a mechanistic dimension, but there's also the hard problem, which the philosophers call that of qualia, the subjective apprehension of something. And it really is strange when you stop to think about it. So what is it? How does this arise? How do we go from being physically describable entities, the chemical nature, but how do we go from chemicals to consciousness? Which traditions, those the personalistic or the mechanistic, which traditions should we trust? Our current science or our longstanding humanistic ideals and our religious institutions and their traditions? A good first step, and this I implied a minute ago, speaking of consciousness, a good first step would be to openly acknowledge that much that is real remains beyond the reach of our current scientific tools and methodologies, that despite the remarkable advances of the empirical approach, much of the science of the human person remains truly, deeply mysterious. Framing our considerations with reflections on the difference between animals and the human animal and machines provides a helpful heuristic, conceptual bookends, if you will, in the story of our nature. Animals as essentially corporeal beings and machines as abstract information processing devices provide useful conceptual poles for clarifying the distinguishing characteristics of our species. To begin our consideration of the bookends by comparing humans and machines seems at first to be harder. But at least at this point in our technological process, it's far easier. No one denies that humans are animals or that animals resemble humans in important respects. The question has always been, what kind of animal are we, and how different from other animals are we? But what does it mean if we are machines? Or perhaps more disturbingly, if some machines are like us? And what does it mean to say our minds are a technology, like other technologies? That our minds are like other technologies in being a set of mechanisms for the routine solution of a class of problems. There's something not quite right here, something smuggled in without our barely noticing it. The human mind is an embodied mind, mysteriously issuing forth from within a living organism, inseparably body and mind, a psychophysical unity. That's the way we experience ourselves, sometimes feeling like floating thought, but then acutely pulled back and aware of our physical frame. It's really weird, isn't it, how we don't think of ourselves as bodies and then all of a sudden we run into a lamppost or something. There we are. And though, since it's a mystery, that intuition could be wrong, it does seem that the mind is materially mediated and therefore arises within the minuscule motions that we casually call mechanisms. And therefore, it is a sort of technology, right? We know, and I mean, I think that's probably absolutely right. Mind is mediated by molecular mechanisms, in part. We have to be careful using that term mechanism, though. It's much more loaded than you might suspect at first. But even if the mind is materially mediated, it is more than a mechanism, since it apprehends and draws into awareness concepts and ideas, immaterial realities that are as real or more real than matter. And by the way, who knows what matter is anyway? I was very good friends with the Nobel laureate, Arthur Kornberg, who discovered, he basically discovered DNA polymerase, that's good enough to say. And he was my teacher as a first year med student at Stanford. And I kept going up and asking him questions. We got to be friends, and I stayed friends with him all through my teaching years while he was still alive, and would go and see him personally every few months. I had a great long, long conversation with him. But he would come to my classes regularly, and he was very much a materialist, very solidly affirming the biochemical basis. He was probably the greatest biochemist in history. And he would come to my class on technology, medicine, and ethics, and he would say to the students, "Everything is matter. Let me make this clear to you. Everything is matter. Romantic love, music appreciation, you know, maybe your voting disposition," he didn't say that. "Everything is matter." And one year, some very shy young female student put up her hand in the back and said, "But Dr. Kornberg, what is matter?" It was a really good comment, actually, and he was totally silenced. So, what is matter? So, mechanisms, molecules, that is, the mind is internally operated, not just externally ordered, like human-created machines. There's a difference. We make machines. We put our intelligence and our intentions into the machines. But in our own body, those are us, our intentions. There's a self in there with qualities of consciousness, including sentience, subjectivity, feelings, and sense of freedom. And these are very unlike mechanism. I'm good friends with a neurobiologist, Antonio Damasio. And he's written really very, very engaging books. He's a wonderful writer, beautiful prose. His most famous book is probably Descartes' Error, but he's written a whole series of books. And there's one out that came out, you know, a year or two ago called Feeling and Knowing. And it's short. You guys took me about 3 days to read it, but you could read it in a few hours. It shows how the human being, and he believes consciousness arises from our grounding as feeling beings. And he believes that illuminates the origins of consciousness in their primordial form, even as far back as insects. But what his notion is that the homeostatic mechanisms and the responsive mechanisms of our body are the ground for knowing. And I think that's right. And that we learn and know and frame up our concepts of the world not just through kind of ratiocination, the kind of reason being, but through feeling our way through. And I'm going to talk more about that as we proceed. Just wanted to put that into your minds. Computational machines, computers, and human reasoning may seem similar in their logical operation and cause and effect relations. But in the human mind, there are other kinds of thinking, surrounding, suffusing, and strategically deploying the raw computational powers of the mind, their hopes. Think about your own mind, how you think and how it arises within you. There are hopes and there are fears. There's a sifting, sorting, searching out for solutions with meaning and personal significance that's been called by Charles Sherrington, the enchanted loom. Early in the computer revolution, Stanford psychologist David Rummelhart, how many of you have heard of David Rummelhart? Hey, good for you. All right. So David Rummelhart famously said, the knowledge is in the connections. And though at the time it was a brilliant insight regarding machine operations that set the foundation for neural net technologies, it was a brilliant insight regarding human operations, and it's been a key to the development of neural net and machine learning. But taken literally, the knowledge in the connections, it cannot be true. There is no knower in a computational device. The computer knows nothing of the content or meaning. It has no sense of experience, no center of awareness, no genuine goals motivated by desire. Even the terms it is trained on are reduced to digital tokens to be sifted, sorted, and shoveled in the search for mathematical ratios and statistically predictive patterns. It is neutral with regard to purpose, values, and genuine knowledge. And I am aware that it's not just patterns in the strict one-to-one sense. The newer large language models, transformers, are now searching out plausible predictions and somehow grasping what appear to be anticipatory knowledge, but it's still mathematically conducted without a knower in the process. So it's digital. It's not the analog of human existence, and it's not got the internal quality of being. Leibniz warned us. Moreover, it must be confessed that perception and that which depends upon it are inexplicable on mechanical grounds, that is to say, by means of figures and motions. And supposing there were a machine so constructed as to think, feel, and have perceptions, it might be conceived as increased in size while keeping the same proportions, so that one might go into it as into a mill. That being so, we should, on examining its interior, find only parts which work one upon another and never anything by which to explain a perception. What a thought. It's as though we could get very, very tiny and walk through our brains and watch the neurotransmitters going along in the cell circuits. But we wouldn't feel it. We wouldn't know what it was exactly. See how it worked, maybe, but it would be abstract. The astrophysicist Arthur Eddington put it more plainly. Our knowledge of physical and the knowledge of physics is only an empty shell, a form of symbols. It's knowledge of structural form and not knowledge of content. All through the physical world runs that unknown content, which must surely be the stuff of our consciousness. That may seem like an abstract comment, but if you really look at physics, it's very interesting. My brother has a PhD in low temperature physics, and that's why I became a biologist. You never do what your brother does. But talking with him, it's really amazing how strange physics, the physicist concept of matter actually is. I'm always disarmed. It turns out statistically, so the large language model could pick this up, turns out that biologists tend to be more atheistic than chemists, and chemists more atheistic than physicists. In fact, there are quite a few physicists who are serious practicing Christians and other religious dispositions. My first physics teacher was Arthur Shallow, and then I knew his colleague Charles Townes. They got the Nobel Prize for discovering the laser. And both of them were very deeply serious Christian scientists. And most, not like Christian science, but Christian science. And they had the humility of knowing what physics didn't know. So that's unknown content that runs through the physical world, that unknown content must be the stuff of our consciousness. But what is that unknown content that Eddington speaks of? and how does human consciousness grasp hold of it? 25 years ago, Terry Winograd, professor of computer science at Stanford, argued that the human mind is infinitely more complicated than mathematical logic would allow. That the patchwork rationalism, reasoning with simple facts and rules, that had guided AI research for the previous 30 years was a misuse of analogy and a wrong-minded approach. He stated plainly, seekers after the glitter of intelligence are misguided in trying to cast it in the base metal of computing. Winograd cautioned that computers may be better understood as language machines. See, he was very ahead of his time. Machines that manipulate symbols, machine code, rather than thinking machines. But he noted that human language, unlike machine code, ultimately depends on tacit understandings, not susceptible to mechanistically determinable mathematical logic. Now that's a concept that's maybe a little hard at first to grasp, or maybe it's obvious to all of you. Tacit understanding, that's the kind of embodied understanding that we have. Tacit, as implicit, implied but not stated, with a content that's understood but not expressed, and maybe inexpressible. It's partly that feeling that Damasio talks about. It's that sense of what it is to be contextually present as a potent but perishable living being. Tacit knowledge, the broad awareness of reality, something grasped through the active experience of living, inseparably thought and feeling, known within the fullness of embodied being. Tacit knowledge, carried unconsciously as the background context for every thought and embedded in every experience of human language, but irreducible to mathematical logic. I know some people think that everything will be finally be reducible. I have a big argument with my son, who's a senior in high school and just applying for early admissions to Stanford to join his older brother. And he's under a lot of pressure. If he gets in, he'll be the 21st member of our family to go to Stanford. If he doesn't get in, he'll be the only one ever to be rejected. Well, he knows. He has a tacit understanding of what that feels like. So the human mind, for the human mind, the term tacit was described that I didn't know how to put tacit down, but I think looking at that guy's face, you can sense he's a human being and he's not a machine. He knows a lot of things he can't explain. So we're not just computing devices. I'll say it again in a minute, but human beings do not compute and computers do not think. At least not in the sense we really mean those words. So tacit knowledge. For the human mind, tacit was described by Michael Pagliani as personal knowledge. As he explained, we can know more than we can tell. What a statement. We can know more than we can tell. He went on to say that not only is there knowledge that cannot be adequately articulated by verbal means, but also that all knowledge is rooted in such tacit knowledge. Maybe some of you have seen, there's a famous quote by Albert Camus, the existential author, an interesting guy, the theologian I studied with, Louis Bouillet, he was French. He knew Camus, and he said Camus converted to Christianity on his deathbed. I don't know if it's true, but I could believe it, reading his ideas. He had a depth and a certain openness. But Camus commented that physics is described in metaphor. That, you know, we use these terms like force. Well, what do we mean by force? We experience force, something pushing against something else. But if we didn't have that embodied experience, that word might not mean anything to us. And our language is full of metaphors. Metaphors carry the embodied experience, much of which is just tacit. We can't explain why we know it or how we know it, but it's there. So knowledge rooted all knowledge, according to Pailani, is personal knowledge rooted in our tacit knowledge. If one steps back to consider more deeply what is actually going on in the embodied human mind, it's clear that it is dramatically unlike machine processing. The flesh and blood human being, the organismal self, has a distinct human awareness of existential realities, of personal place and purpose within the world. And like every organism, it dwells as precarious being, potent but perishable, and with a sense, with all sentient beings, of passionate and purposeful existence. We're churning and bubbling within the multiple streams of pleasures and pains, memories and aspirations, hopes and fears. If you really try to step back and analyze what's going on in your mind, it's virtually impossible, because you're then using your mind to think, and you don't even know quite what the words mean. They have semantic domains. They come with feelings. So multiple streams, you know this. Everything that happens, you know, you interpret, whether it's leading to your ultimate goals, whether it's fulfilling your aspirations consistent with your memories, how it relates to your hopes and fears. And if we have time, I want to get at this later, because I think ultimately behind everything, there is something integrated in the soul of a human being that aims toward an ultimate consummation of those motions of pleasure and pain, memories, aspirations, hopes and fears. In the Catholic tradition, that carries the term the beatific vision, which means an ultimate union with God. This human interpretive frame of tacit knowledge is of the personal autobiographical self, the narrative self, our sense of who we are, the nature of the world and our place in it. A vast and varied store of memories and personal intentions sets the content of every thought. And these in turn are embedded within the interpretive context of our culture, within a mythic cosmology of origins and ultimate ends. Tacit understanding, personal knowledge, flowing forth from the inward experience of our human journey within the world. Today, the impoverished patchwork rationalism that Winograd talked about, the patchwork rationalism of earlier, has been transcended or superseded by the deeper and more opaque processes of so-called machine learning, algorithms and statistical models that computer systems use to effectively perform a specific task without explicit instructions. But again, the machine is not like the human mind. It appears to employ an entirely different mode of operation, intense pattern recognition, a kind of brute force processing in search of functional solutions. That's requiring a lot of energy too, you know. It's lacking the subtlety and comprehensive personal content and character of human cognition. Pattern identification, not perception. Mathematical correlation, not thinking. Yet this conclusion collides with the impressions and the impressive computer powers of things like the large language models such as ChatGPT. These have the surprising capacity to summarize articles, make jokes, write a personal resume, and even give relationship advice, right? That's just to name a few. All without having even been to kindergarten. Engaging with ChatGPT comes with the uncanny feeling that one is interacting with another human being, and a smart one, though a somewhat quirky one, right? In fact, in a strange, indirect sort of way, one is interacting with other human beings, lots of them, as you all know. ChatGPT is trained on the collective internet text of the entire human family, 500 billion words, the equivalent of 45 million long novels, terabytes of data. all the thought experiences, conversations, and conclusions encoded into mindable text, a source reflecting our collective human culture, virtually everything put into written form. Yet ChatGPT doesn't understand a word of it, at least not in the way that humans understand. It is simply a high-dimensional statistical model of the patterns of letters within words, words within sentences, and sentences within the flow of a wider text. It recognizes organized sequences while knowing nothing of their meaning, only their relational structure. It's a matter of prediction, not perception, and meaningful thought. In fact, what should amaze us is not what large language models tell us about the capacities of computers, but rather what they tell us about human language. What they reveal is something amazing. What they reveal has been largely unrecognized, and that is the deep layers of meaning contained in the very structure of our language. Typically, we speak of the two major elements of language as in separate terms of description. So you all know there's syntax, which is the way words are ordered and put together, arranged to form phrases, clauses, and sentences, the structural element of language. And then the other side of it, the other term of description, is semantics, the meaning carried by language. ChatGPT reveals the unrecognized depth of connection between these two aspects of language, how meaning is embedded and conveyed within the structure of the language. Large language models go beyond mere word-by-word autofill or autocomplete to recognize patterns in the deep structure, word context, and connections they carry that carry meaning in language, but still without understanding anything of the words themselves. In other words, there's a lot of meaning conveyed in the construction of our language. And I read a really interesting thing the other day about how we use language just so casually without having to think about it much. But I read something about the word sequence for adjectives. And I can't remember exactly how it went, but it said that the way you use words, there's conventions with regard to whether you put time, color, action, whatever, in the sequence. So he talked to the old man with his red wrinkled face. It feels different if you change the order of those words. It doesn't feel comfortable. It conveys something different. I can't think it up fast enough, but maybe he talked with the man old with a wrinkled and red face. You can just feel it. It doesn't feel right. And there's tons of subtlety in that kind of thing. I mean, think if you said, for example, that somebody walked down the stairs versus came down the stairs. It just has a slight different meaning because you come down the stairs, but you walk down the stairs implies like you're getting well or something. You're actually capable of walking instead of just coming down. You see what I'm saying there? It's weird. All sorts of subtle meanings are poured into language that we don't recognize, and the alternate use of them jars us and alerts us to a different meaning. He came down the stairs. Finally, his leg is well enough that he can actually... He walked down the stairs. He didn't just come down the stairs. He walked down. His leg is healed. He can walk. See? It's amazing. And I think there's a lot more going on a subtle level than that. And here's a little throwaway for some of you who can explore this, because I don't have time. But you all know that, as I assume many of you are from the Catholic community here, and you all know the word logos, which... It doesn't just mean word, it means account or the story of something, biology or geology, logos. It's a comprehensive descriptive account. Of course, that's Christ is the logos who makes sense of the world. It's not just strict reason like ratiocination. It includes a whole comprehension of the meaning of existence. Well, I think the substructures of logos, which philosophers label as the logoi, are buried in our language. So somebody, one of you should do a PhD on that. You'd find some very interesting connection between ancient philosophical thought and the large language models. Of course, all this subtlety of language has not been generated by the large language models. It's been detected in the connection of words and meanings, buried but effectively present in human written expression. It's human knowledge, human experience, and intelligence that is informing the capacities of ChatGPT. And of course, large language models will also express human limitations, our biases, and even errors in human understanding. They are universal mimic machines, not truth seekers. Still, in revealing the connection between syntax and semantics, large language models may shine light on the way language reflects and reveals the operation of the depths of the human mind and depths of reality, the logoi. In a strange sort of way, our language, the emanation of our lived experience in the world, may reveal that we know more about the depth of reality than we consciously understand that we know. And this brings us directly to the mystery of how we know anything at all, how language arises and serves as a medium of human communication and the bearer of human culture. To understand this, we need to recognize how these capacities are grounded in the structure and dynamics of our embodied existence, life lived within a world that itself speaks to us through our experience, both physical and interpersonal, as an intelligible language of being. The world is itself an intelligible substructure for understanding that we gain through living in it. The given world is not just a neutral backdrop. It's like a stage set for our lives, but the ground of the tacit knowledge that infuses all thought, language, and action, and all meaning are there. And that's very much in keeping with the Thomistic tradition, which affirms that it's our experience of the world, our sensory apprehension, that delivers to us the intelligence with which we can operate. So machine learning for now, it's still just a metaphor. And like all metaphors, it carries a certain limited analogy of similarity, but it is not the thing to which it is compared. The Turing test is not an indicator of human consciousness in a computer, but the measure of the gullibility of the human observer. Those who dispense wild speculations about complete uploading of the human mind in silico would do well to reflect on the indispensable role of the body, the organic substrate that supports the functioning of human consciousness, the body with all the complexity of personal context and content that that implies. So these reflections on tacit knowledge and embodied knowing lead out of Silicon Valley or MIT to the marshlands and mountains on either side. And it leads us directly back to living nature and the mystery of animal minds, and most problematically, the question of what and how the human mind is mediated by matter and emerges within the dynamic of human physical, personal, social, and spiritual development. Animal minds, what are they? How different are they? And this brings us to important considerations on the concept of soul.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.